Donalana Kitchen talks about food. Donalana Kitchen talks recipes. Donalana Kitchen talks about lots of other things on community radio.
The Donalana Kitchen Show is sponsored in part by the Mucky Duck Pub, where pub means community. More information can be found at www.themuckyduckpub.com or from Marcus at telephone number 232-8888.
Welcome to the Donalana Kitchen. My name is Lana Noctical.
And I'm Donna Prisigintas.
We gather here once a week around our kitchen table to talk about food, farming, advice, recipes, and opinions. And this is community radio. We've got a fun drive coming up to support this fine community radio station. Stay tuned. And if we're in your ears, put us in your heart. Yes, yes. KHOI Community Radio. I hope everyone had a little look-see outside last night and got to see the super moon, a really big, pretty moon coming up, Donna. It was lovely.
Yes, not a cloud in the sky.
Yes, I had to figure out, I kind of reacquainted with myself with the concept of orbits and apogees and epogees and the fact that it was closer. And anyway, it's nice to know we're part of something much bigger than ourselves. Today, we're going to be talking about agroecology and farm policy. And remember the Green Revolution? And we'll have a look at Africa, too. Joining us today in the kitchen are two women who have something to say about agroecology. I'm going to introduce Lydia English. She is on the staff of PFI, Practical Farmers of Iowa. She works with Strategic Initiative team to connect farmers with outreach opportunity and equips farmers with resources they need to be effective advocates of cover crops and small grains. Lydia English, welcome to the Donalana Kitchen.
Thanks so much for having me.
And we also have, once again, Dr. Cornelia Flora. She has such a big bio that I think I never adequately introduced her. She is the one of our national stars in rural sociology, I must say, and has worked with all kinds of agricultural systems all over the world. She is an ISU professor emeritus, right, Neil?
And Emerita.
Emerita, yes, right. Okay, among other things, but Neil is really, really active. And one of the reasons we wanted to have her on today is because she has been working a lot with some of the, let's call them the side effects of this program called AGRA, which is in Africa. And there's a new report out called False Promises, the Alliance for Green Revolution in Africa, which is an acronym is AGRA, and it is a product of the Gates Foundation. I'm going to read this one small quote to set this thing up. It's from Mark Bittman's new book called Animal Vegetable Junk, History of Food from Sustainable to Suicidal.
Oh, my.
Yes. Well, Mr. Bittman does have a way of putting things. So he says, what might be called the peasant food system feeds 70% of the world's population with just 25% of its agricultural resources. Industrial agriculture uses the other 75% to produce food that reaches to fewer than a third of the world's people, in part because half of what's produced by big ag isn't even meant to feed humans. Ignored by state-funded research, fought by global finance, discouraged by most rulers, peasant farming remains more efficient than industrial farming. Were it given the kind of support that's been lent to industry-backed farming, research subsidies, cheap or free land and such, it would become still better. Instead, those resources are siphoned away from the people who could build a real food system, instead used to ensure profits for industrial agriculture. Okay, Neil, that's what Mark Bittman has to say. Tell us about what's been going on with this new report that shows that after 20 years, all of the money put in by the Bill and Melinda Gates, of which they funded two-thirds of this whole project, and they set their own timeline of 20 years to kind of mark how it was progressing. It's been a dismal failure, but they're not really acknowledging this. So tell us about your experiences working with some of these NGOs.
One of the problems, there's some good things going on, and I'll tell a little bit about that. But that's in resistance to this tech fix kind of approach that much of agriculture has been taking. We'll just get the right technology, and then we'll sequester carbon magically. We will stop climate change. Everybody will be healthy. But what they don't understand is they're working in a system. And as colonists, we worked very hard to destroy the sustainable systems that were in place. When the English and the French got to Africa, they couldn't get people to grow things like corn, a water-intensive crop, and to sell, to send back to the country. So they imposed a hut tax that could only be paid by growing these few crops from which the colonizers could make a profit. And Iowa was settled much the same way. The railroads came through, and they were, land was given away so that basic carbohydrates could be grown, it could be shipped back to this increasing the industrialized workforce. So we have tasked agriculture with this strange goal of increasing what Vilsack has called industrial inputs, which is what we frankly are now growing in Iowa, which we will use technology to transform occasionally into things people will eat, but more often into things people will buy and then throw away. So this concern with technology as the end goal, which
as an improvement, right?
Is an improvement and measured by increasing production of one commodity per acre. Excuse me, is really done a lot of damage. And even Borlaug said, when he made this 20 years after winning the Nobel Prize for this great technology from the Green Revolution, said, the real problem is poverty, not food. And unless we address poverty, and we do it from systems, and we do it appreciating what people can do and know how to do, we're going to just, we'll have lots of cheap carbohydrates, but we won't have very much else. So I'm working with a group right now that we're doing something we call inclusive agriculture and rural development, which says our bottom line has to be addressing poverty. That's both rural poverty and urban poverty worldwide. And one of the ways you do that is by having a systems approach to what is going on. And some of this literature that they're putting out is saying, well, sustainable intensification is very different than agroecology. But I'm currently working with a project now where we're actually using sustainable intensification, not to introduce this magical Gates Foundation agro magic seed or introducing diesel-driven traction to plow more land, but working with what people already do, what they do well, helping them become more diversified. But for example, many of these Gates-funded projects are busy introducing mechanical traction. So you import you import the machinery. You have to import the diesel that's used when you pollute the air using it. The project I'm working with, which is called the Sustainable Intensification Innovation Lab, which is based at Kansas State University, is working with local farmers, local blacksmiths, local scholars to make, for example, agronomic harnesses. You know, the old way of plowing, you put the yoke over the neck of the oxen or the burro, the donkey. which is not a very, it's an easy way to get the yolk on, but it's not a very good way for the animal to have to use all those neck muscles to plow. So instead, working with these local artisans, they're making ergonomic harnesses that go around the front of the animals that allow them to use their real muscles so they can plow more, faster, and be healthier. So that these, which is, and so you've got a local industry that has improved. And then they're working with the things already, people already grow, like millet. But using a little bit of technology, which is adding zinc to the millet seed, and then women are taking the millet, which is a drought-resistant crop, unlike corn, which we've all are noticing and will really notice it this year.
Summer.
Why corn is not drought resistant. And so we have more Iowa farmers irrigating, which was unheard of, at least in the eastern part of the state. And so all of a sudden we're having this huge shift because we're growing a crop that does not adapt well to climate change. So we've got a an arid land, and we're growing an arid land crop, but it's mixed with things like cowpeas. So you've got a diversified farming system. And the farmers love intercropping cowpeas, which, by the way, are leguminous. They've helped the local blacksmiths rather than purchasing machinery from the U.S. or Europe, or even the urban areas. The local blacksmiths have planters where you can insert the seed deep enough without plowing and then have a little bit of manure behind that seed as you put it in the ground. I mean, very innovative things that can be done locally by local people, so you're keeping the resources there. And so these women are making all sorts of really neat baby food products out of this improved millet. And they've got a new industry that's local, that sells locally and helps local children do better.
What country is this in, Neil?
Well, it's in Senegal. It was in Burkina Faso. This is in West Africa. Mm-hmm. And they're also working, but a bit differently, in Ethiopia and in Bangladesh. So it's an interesting project, but this is the places where I've done the field visits are in West Africa. It's also working some in Tanzania, or was. So, but the point is, we use local people. We don't use them. The local people are the partners in coming up with what technologies you use. And those partners are not just the university professors, who are outstanding, and the university students, who are busy there. Actually, Peace Corps volunteers have been involved working with master farmers, learning what they do, and then helping them adapt because climate change is very real there. So this, we know this can be done. And so there is a group that I am honored to be part of where we're arguing for inclusive agriculture and rural development, where we're trying to say, let's not just focus on producing a few food crops, you know, rice and corn and wheat aren't going to do it. When I first started working in the Philippines, which was a long, long time ago, you could visit the rice paddies, and all around would be all these wonderful plants that were then served with meals. Those were your vegetables. So you didn't need to fortify rice with vitamins because they were there in these plants that people harvested. Well, as soon as you get miracle variety in there, you start using pesticides that kill, of course, all those plants that were part of a balanced diet. And you have all these sudden vitamin deficiencies. So instead of saying, well, maybe we shouldn't use as many pesticides, maybe we should go back to some of these traditional systems. We worked really hard to put vitamins in rice. It was called golden rice. And of course, they began putting it in the wrong rice. They put it in Indica rice rather than Japonica rice. Those are long grain versus short grain. And it's shattered. And the way poor people eat rice is they buy it, it's still in the hull, and they pound it. And if you pound it, the outside should break, and you should have the rice grain. But this rice, you pounded it, the whole grain shattered. So this really, the notion of technology, oh, we've got this great idea, but not understanding the local situation, the local context, what women did, what men did, was all really very problematic. Oh, look, coffee is around. So there's all these possibilities of doing development differently. And we're trying to convince people the problem is not food. The problem is the right kind of food that is accessible to everyone in a way that is dignified and still tastes good.
Well, do you think that this assessment of the 20 years of AGRA and its lack of success, well, it certainly speaks well for the kind of work that you're trying to do. But do you feel like, I mean, obviously the Gates Foundation has not acknowledged this. What is it? But do you feel like it's having an effect in governmental circles? Are people rethinking the Green Revolution?
Well, I just was yesterday on a long conversation with one of my colleagues on this IARD group who got very depressed when he went to meet with some of the folks in USAID because they're still thinking very narrowly. They're thinking, let's just do food. And they're highly influenced by the old AGRA model. So we're trying to say what would be another road in terms of looking at rural development internationally and agricultural development. What is another inroad where we can begin to say, no, we're doing the wrong thing? But also, if we understand how to better have integrated farming systems in the Midwest, we will be able to say, this is what works even better. This is what works to keep farmland in the hands of the farmers who are actually farming the land. This is a way to have healthy populations. Because the problem is you can be obese and still be malnourished. And that's what we've been seeming to do in the U.S. quite a bit.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And it can happen in developing countries as well. So that gaining weight may or may not be a sign of eating a healthy diet. So what can be done domestically possibly can influence what we're doing internationally. And if we're going to invest internationally, we have to say, we have to think about the people and the not just climate smart. We have to think about the ecosystem, but we also have to think about ecosystem smart means we're thinking about the people, the animals, the biodiversity, the quality of the water, the quality of the air. And I'm going to quote an old Tom Lear song that you may have known and loved, which was GDP is rising, GDP is rising, GDP is rising, but you can't drink the water or breathe the air. And we're sort of in this situation. That we're getting, for example, we're getting all these wonderful warehouses in Iowa. Well, those warehouses mean a whole lot of diesel trucks going by. It means a whole lot of particulates in the air. And it means the people who live by those warehouses have serious health problems coming up. And there's studies that have shown that in other places. So we have to stop looking at single tech solutions. But think about what is this happening in the whole system? And one of the things we're learning and PFI has learned is it works best when you work with the people who are actually doing the work, the people who are closest to the land and who can innovate and get to know it.
Well, that brings us to the second article, which it was in Civil Eats. It's, is agroecology being co-opted by big ag? And it has a lot to do with this conference at the UN that's coming up in September, actually. It was supposed to be about agroecology and the food and ag organization. They've now changed it to nature positive production. And a bunch of agroecology researchers are refusing to attend, saying that are they making junk agroecology? What do you think about this, Neil?
I think that's, I'm sorry we won't have those voices there, but would they have even been listened to? When we've got this, a techno fix rather than a systems approach and calling it climate neutral or ecosystem friendly, is still not realizing that people are part of the system. And that how do we make sure that we're including the people who live in these rural communities? How are we including the people who are working on the land? How are we dealing with the people who harvest the food? How are we dealing with where it is processed? We've seen what's happened when we consolidated meat processing, for example. And we now that meat went further and further and further, grown in less and less and less ecologically friendly circumstances with huge help for the workers and the communities in which they work. And we saw this with COVID-19 in Iowa. The COVID rates were so much higher in communities with with the big industrial packing plants, as opposed to the local meat lockers. So that these things have unintended consequences. And what you measure is what you do. And if all you're measuring is bushels per acre, you're missing a whole lot. And so we have a Secretary of Agriculture that proclaimed water in Iowa is doing just fine without a single measurement of it, without any way to say, our voluntary system is great. Just use maybe a little less nitrogen sometimes. But they're not even recommending that. It just keep what we're doing.
It sounds like we're dealing with power here too, and terminology, the people that decide what to measure, what to talk about, what to value. And we're at a point in our history where we've been noticing climate change and mass migrations and drought and famine as if there were always some. But when that's on the nightly news quite a bit, I think we better take a look at how we are relating to our earth, the earth that feeds us. We're talking about agroecology today. It sounds like a good idea, this agroecology thing, but we're finding out what's really happening when people can affect the way we grow food. We'll be back in a little bit. I just want to take this time to say this is KHOI, and this is the Donalana Kitchen, tasty radio for the heart of Iowa. Welcome back. Welcome back. You are listening to the Donal on a Kitchen. We're talking about farm policy and agroecology, and maybe in some cases, junk agroecology, how we are affecting the way that we grow food. We heard Dr. Cornelia Flora talk about what's working and not working in Africa. But there's food grown in this part of the country too. After all, Adana often says we are in the belly of the beast. We're talking with Cornelia Flora and Lydia English. Lydia English is from Practical Farmers of Iowa. How does what happens in these agroecology summits and, oh, we're going to save the world with green ecology, and what's PFI doing? Lydia, tell us what's happening in Iowa.
Sure thing. Thanks, Lana. PFI, we were a nonprofit here in Ames. You know, we were founded in the 1980s and amid the farm crisis. And I always like to say, like, our bread and butter as an organization has always been, on-farm research that's sort of farmer-led, and then farmer-to-farmer knowledge sharing. And those continue to be, you know, our values since our founding. So farmers at the center of sort of tinkering and investigating on their own farm, and then sharing those with other farmers in sort of like a bottom-up or a grassroots way, you could say. I work on the strategic initiatives team at PFI, and this team sort of coalesced probably around like 8 years ago with the idea that while that farmer-to-farmer knowledge sharing and investigation is important and creates like real change, there are also other levers we can pull, so to speak, in this agricultural system that we live in and here in Iowa, to try and create more change on the landscape, to try and, you know, get more farmers farming, to try and have it be profitable for them, to try and have things be, you know, both environmentally sustainable and help with water quality and erosion and things that we're all sort of intimately aware are issues here in Iowa if we're sort of in the ag realm. And so we've been really spearheading work around getting farmers, or helping farmers, to adopt cover crops. And the extension of that is to adopt small grains in their cropping rotation, in addition to corn and soybeans, which many of us see during the summer when we drive around Iowa. And so that's sort of been what we've been trying to push on. We have been doing a lot of cost share, I would say, within those two practices, starting in about 2015. And we can get into this more. I think it relates to that article that you all mentioned, talking about sort of company investment, but a lot of our cost share is privately funded.
Tell us what cost share means for a farmer.
Oh, yes, I'm sorry. It's pretty much like a payment to what we'd like to think of it as, like a payment to help de-risk the process of adopting a practice. And so we provide cost share for farmers to add cover crops to their operation. Cover crops are an added expense sort of at face value. So, you know, they're a crop that's grown in between your cash crops. It's, you know, not harvested for any sort of, you know, purely traditional economic value, but it provides a lot of these values like water quality, helping infiltration and keeping the ground covered. It can provide forage for livestock simultaneously. But again, you have to buy that seed for the cover crop. You have to apply it to your farm. And so, you know, it is an extra cost. And so we've provided cost share, at, you know, $10 an acre to help farmers de-risk that process of trying cover crops. And we're, you know, trying to increase that pool of cost share folks of every year. And in addition to just sort of handing them a check to help de-risk that process, we also provide, you know, technical assistance and sort of envelope them into our farmer network at PFI to try and get them connected with other farmers and sort of asking questions to each other, because adopting any new practice takes time to figure out how it's going to work for your system. So what might work for someone in another county might not work for you, or might not work for you that year even. And so it's, you know, being patient and sort of seeing what works one year and sort of asking those questions and going to field days to learn from others. So yeah, that's what the cost share is about, but it sort of leads into a larger PFI involvement and network.
And explain where PFI gets the money to pay the cost share to the farmers.
Yeah, so for our cover crop cost share, again, it's all private money that's linked to to corn and soybean supply chains. So we get the bulk of it from PepsiCo and Unilever. And so they are investing dollars to the farm gate. They're investing in PFI to help administer the cost share. And that's sort of helping them make their supply chain more sustainable, so to speak. And so, you know, going back to this article and sort of the criticism that companies are sort of cherry picking practices and you know, not really addressing the whole system. Yeah, I hear that, but I also want to start somewhere and I want to get something on the ground. And, you know, I appreciate companies that are willing to invest in farmers. And, you know, Neil talked about having local partners and making sure we're listening to our farmers on the ground. And, you know, companies like Pepsi and Unilever really value PFI because we are that link. You know, we are intimately involved with the growers in our network. We are constantly looking for feedback and trying to listen to them because, you know, our job is really to serve them and their interests and their needs. I would say not all companies are willing to invest and put money into the farm gate, put money into the farmer's pocket to be like, we would love for you to like adopt a regenerative agriculture practice. Like, here is some money to help you de-risk that process and sort of share the cost with you, you know, risk share together, you adding this, for your benefit and for ours. A lot of companies might just do, or we have some experience with some companies just, you know, lip service for that sort of regenerative agriculture. But there are some that we work with, like Pepsi and Unilever, that are sort of, you know, putting their money where their mouth is, at least in our network, and, you know, helping and want to continue to sort of figure out how to make that cost share work and how to continue to reach people that want to be reached and make sure that, you know, they're adopting the practices that are, you know, going to help with these environmental qualities, but then also, you know, make their farming system more profitable and resilient in the future. And we don't want to see farmers going away from farming. We want more farmers here on the land and more people on the land. So yes, it all sort of intertwined.
That's true. Neil talked about when we talk about small farmers as growing food to actually eat, the term peasant comes up. What exactly is a farmer anyway? I mean, we talk about small farmers here in Iowa, but we're peasants too. We're not big. We're not big conglomerations that own land but don't farm it. The idea that small farmers, that peasants, that are, they're actually doing, the importance of actually giving information and help and encouragement to people who are actually on the land. And also the idea that we have such a big conglomeration of capitalist enterprises here, incremental steps when it comes to changes are probably a good idea. What do you think about that? Should we just throw out the baby with the bathwater, or should we do some incremental step stuff?
One of the things that I've seen two proposals that are coming up, one from Iowa State University and one from University of Wisconsin. They're looking at perennial cover crops. That means you don't have to buy seed every year. It means they will be in the ground. They will be sequestering carbon. They will be permeating the soil so it can hold more water. And this is something also that farmers sort of had to learn, that roots in the ground don't necessarily mean competition with crops. It means it's got the soil holding water for everything that's growing. And the other piece that's coming with that is the understanding that perhaps when you're having these cover crops, perhaps an integrated crop and livestock system works the best, so that you have not confined animals, but you have a small herd of cattle, or
they can move around,
herd of hogs that goes out and harvests your cover crop for you. And that's harder for people to deal with, because we're so used to being told the really great thing is build a CAFO and somebody else will provide the hogs, but you provide the setting for the hogs. I used to call them hog hotels. And So that looks like financially a good thing to do. But how much better if you actually had the animals, had the chance to let them out on your property, their hooves on the ground, particularly hogs who used to have nice sharp hooves on the ground to dug in. Now at Iowa State long ago, we bred flat-footed hogs. Their hooves were flat so they could stand up.
Funny, but flat-footed hogs.
So they could
hogs.
Stand up on the concrete.
Oh, you're
in
kidding.
The cave hooves. No, this is, this is pretty amazing how we said we can get a tech solution to this. Those hogs are slipping around on all that concrete with their little pointy hooves, which they use for digging, which is why they use hogs to find truffles in France. But we'll make them flat-footed, so since they will never get out to dig anyway. And then getting the manure out of the building, use a lot of labor to sweep it out. So we'll use water. So now we have substituted water for manual labor. So in a drought situation, we're still flushing out those hog houses with lots of water that then go into lagoons that then leak. And then we have, but so to get your
pollution.
Master matrix.
Yeah.
So you, but then you're supposed to put that just full so you don't want it bursting out. So you have acres that can't be too far away where you put on the nitrogen fertilizer. Or the supposed nitrogen fertilizer that comes from your hog waste. You never test that hog waste for what are the nutrients that are actually in it or what are the antibiotic-resistant bacteria that may be in it. And you don't necessarily have to test the soils in the fields where you're putting it. You just have an owner say, yeah, you can put it on my field. So this means there's a whole lot of leakage off those fields, too. But when we're looking for simple tech fixes that are very linear, we have these problems that we create for ourselves, and then we're surprised.
Yeah, and I think Neil hits on a lot of good points about the system sort of positive feedback loops in the system and sort of this self-perpetuating environmental externalities that we might see on the landscape. To go back to your question, Lana, about incremental change, I do, and anecdotally, you know, we have farmers in our network that start with cover crops. You know, they start with just cereal rye cover crops, and it does, you know, I think, and I have to hope, and I take solace from these stories of farmers who are starting with cover crops and then deciding like, hey, I'm going to grow my own cover crop seed because I can here in Iowa. And, you know, most of the time they're growing rye, a small grain. So then they're extending their rotation for 1 year to grow a small grain. And hopefully we can sort of coach them to grow clover underneath their small grain crop and grow some of their own nitrogen. And then, hey, we can sort of coach them like, why don't you try cutting some of the nitrogen that usually you'd put on your corn the next year because you grew some of it the year before in your clover. And so it might not be everyone and it might be slow, but I think that we can see some small steps in terms of helping farmers get comfortable with cover crops, get comfortable trying something new, maybe get excited about trying something new and wanting to continue to tweak. And then, yeah, maybe integrating livestock and getting livestock out on the land, like Neil was mentioning. You know, we have Megan Filbert, our livestock program manager, has worked with a group to pilot a Midwest grazing exchange, which is sort of like a matchmaking service for landowners and farmers with livestock. So that if you have land and you don't have cattle, but you want cattle grazing your cover crops or something, you could find someone in your area and sort of facilitate that grazing that benefits both parties. So I think in my line of work, I have to hope that some of these incremental changes that we're really trying to hammer home and get people on the ground excited about and co-learning do hopefully help and work and lead to some larger change on the landscape.
Well, incremental changes, when you think about it, nature is incremental. It takes a long time. If you've ever grown a tomato plant, you don't just plant it and eat it the next day. We have to learn to be patient, but we also have to learn to be aware of the actions that we do, because If you do something, it makes a difference. If you don't do something, it makes a difference. We are part of this long, long-term, amazingly dynamic thing. And the more we understand it, the better. Understanding the whole of it, not just the little bit of it. This, another mention here that this is KHOI, and this is the Donna Lana Kitchen. You can find out more about us at www.khoifm.org. Welcome back. This is the Donna Lana Kitchen.
So we're talking about all kinds of farming things here. Neil, could you draw some parallels between the systems that we're working with here in Iowa through PFI and the kind of programs that you're seeing in Africa that are very farmer-centric in their approach to changing agriculture in, what are they calling it, nature-positive production?
We don't call it nature positive production.
You still call it agroecology, maybe.
Agroecology, and we also call it poverty reduction. We also call it increasing the quality of life of everyone. And that includes the animals in the system, who are an incredibly important part of it. I'm not urging Iowa farmers to go back to animal traction. I think that probably will not happen. But I'm so impressed with how farmers learn from each other. I get the PFI listservs, and farmers are always asking each other questions. And I think sometimes the professors or the experts from PFI will chime in, but mainly farmers are learning from each other. And I think this is the real strength of PFI, is respecting the people on the land enough to know they are creating knowledge, and nothing is more site-specific than agriculture. And when we have these universal solutions, we're ignoring the essence of our earth. And so so many people, when they answer questions, say, well, this is what works on my land or this part of my land, that there is this recognition of the importance of place. And unless we see agriculture as part of place, our changes won't make much difference.
So could we say that the main failings of the Gates Foundation and the AGRA program that they've instituted in Africa is that it is not sensitive to the needs and of the places and the communities and the farmers? It is a top-down approach?
Well, and it comes from thinking that they already know what the problem is. It's so obvious. You're having low bushels per acre of X crop. So we'll fix that. We'll bring in a new seed that happens to require all these externally purchased inputs. And then you'll get more bushels per acre. And as what I love in this PFI discussions is people say, well, my output didn't change, but my profitability really increased. And that's the part that I really love hearing. It's saying, what is important to us about what we grow? And what are ways we do it more efficiently, which is more efficient for the farmer in terms of how much it costs? And then they discuss, well, this took a little more time, but it was worth it for these reasons. So it's really interesting looking at these discussions, and you can see the things that go into the system. What is the time spent by the farmer? Is it time that they enjoy? Or is it really boring time? Are you out on your combine on 1,000 acres listening to some your music on your iPod, or are you there seeing what's going on and very excited about that? So this is sort of the other pieces that come into a farmer-based solution. But it also means you involve researchers. So researchers are trying to figure